From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, comic Maria Bamford. Much of her comedy is about the most troubling parts of her inner life. She has OCD, bipolar disorder, has considered suicide, and been hospitalized several times. Pretty hysterical, right? But she is really funny and very original. Her autobiographical comedy is also about her family and their reactions to her troubling thoughts. Like this story about her mother.
She couldn't find me in the house once, and she called my sister in a panic and said, Maria has disappeared, and I'm worried she's killed herself, and I have a hair appointment in town. Which, I mean, that is so hilarious.
Bamford has a new comedy album called Ask Me About My New God. And Maureen Corrigan weighs in on the novel we now know was written under a pseudonym by J.K. Rowling. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It almost makes me uncomfortable to laugh at Maria Bamford's comedy because so much of it is about really serious problems she has. OCD, bipolar disorder, suicidal thoughts. She's been hospitalized several times. But I have to laugh because she's that funny. She's done some really odd web shows. The oddest is probably her program, The Special Special Special, which was her doing her act in her living room with her parents on the couch as her only audience. In addition to her stand-up comedy, she's done a lot of animated voiceover work, and you may have seen her on the new Netflix season of Arrested Development, playing a recovering meth addict named Debris, who becomes involved with Tobias. She was on two episodes of Louie last season. Now she has a new CD called Ask Me About My New God that also comes with a DVD of her two Comedy Central specials. Maria Bamford, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show. I want to play something that's from earlier work that you did. And okay. This is from a 2007 show that's actually on DVD along with your CD. And this is your anxiety song. It's called My Anxiety Song. So let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
Well, this is my anxiety song. If I keep the kitchen floor clean, no one will die. As long as I clench my fists at odd intervals, then the darkness within me won't force me to do anything inappropriately violent or sexual at dinner parties. Woof! As long as I keep humming a tune, I won't turn gay. It can't get you if you're singing a song. Yeah!
That's Maria Bamford. I really love that. How many of those anxieties are actually yours? How many of those compulsive behaviors?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, no, those are mine. When I was about 9 years old, I stopped being able to sleep at night because I had fear that I was going to kill my parents, act out violently in some sort of taboo way. And it's even hard for me to say now, act out sexually towards somebody. And so wanted to isolate so that I would not be around people at all and would stay up all night making sure that I just wouldn't fall asleep and somehow lose control and fearing I was going to do those things. And just to explain that that is a type of obsessive compulsive disorder, what it is, it's the equivalent of, you know, washing your hands thinking that you're going to be dirty or that you're somehow dirty, but it's with thoughts. So as soon as you try to not think of the thought pops up again. So because most of us have weird thoughts floating through our heads every once in a while. I know there's I heard a comedian once say, you know, my dog looks kind of sexy today. You know, like things where it's like, oh, that's wrong. But usually nobody thinks twice about that. You just kind of like go, oh, that's weird. And then you pass it. But if you are an anxious person and somehow on high alert, you think, oh, I just thought my dog looked sexy. Well, that must be, I am somehow a dangerous person who, you know, it's sort of this spiraling effect. And I'm of course not any sort of expert or physician, but I did get help for it. I went to an OCD specialist. And within 2 weeks, I was 35 when I went, it was gone. Something that had plagued me for my entire life was gone.
How did that happen?
They did this technique called flooding, where you, the particular one was, I recorded, you know, my worst fear of what's going to happen. You know, I am chopping my friends and family up into chunks and bits. And I do a joke about it. I don't know. It sounds terrifying now with the way I say it, but I do a joke about it, saying like the therapist is the OCD therapist is. So, have you ever not wanted to go to a religious institution because you worried you'd lose control, run up on the altar, take a crap, and yell, "I am a promise keeper"? No. Have you ever not wanted to go to SeaWorld because you're worried if you're left alone with the baby starfish, you'd try to kiss its poop hole? Oh, God, that sounds familiar, but I'm not placing it.
Have you ever not wanted to spend time with friends or family because you were you'd chop them up into chunks and bits and have sex with the chunks and bits and put the chunks and bits on a Cobb salad and feed it to your parents? All the time. God. Aren't you even listening? Anyways, yeah, I mean, it's like those are the thoughts. You know, people have some weird thoughts. And but flooding, what they do is you have the read out loud in the present tense of your worst fear happening. You just listen to it over and over and over again. And, you know, it really limited my life. I did not spend a lot of time with people because I was felt afraid. And stand up was very good for that because I you can spend time with people, but they're safe and you're amplified and lit. And it's a very structured environment. So but now I am freed by the miracles of psychology and science and all that stuff. I mean, if there is a science, we don't know if there is a science, but if there is.
So, you know, maybe it's a sign of my own self-absorption, but my unwanted obsessive thoughts tend to be about things that are going to happen to me as opposed to dangerous things I'm going to do to other people.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everybody has their own special snowflake thumbprint anxiety. What is yours? Do you feel comfortable sharing? You don't have to share.
I probably not, but you know, no, I always worry about things that are gonna, you know, get by getting hurt, about, you know, suffering and pain and things like that. I worry about hurting people's feelings. I don't worry about physically doing harm to them because I just don't feel like I'd even have that in me. Like that's not an, it's like not an, of all the bad impulses I have, that particular thing isn't one of them.
Well, that is the weirdest thing. Like they said, or one of the things the physician I went to said, that people who have any type of OCD are the people who are least likely to have any violent tendencies or any predatorial tendencies or any, you know, like the person who's washing their hands 18 times a day or 1800 times a day is the person least likely to not be clean. You know, like they're going to be some clean people, despite the fact that that's all they worry about is that they're somehow filthy. So, yeah, it doesn't make sense.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actress Maria Bamford. She has a new comedy CD, which is called Ask Me About My New God. You did a comedy special that was just web only that you called The Special, Special, Special. And I've never seen anything like it. Your family, your parents make an appearance in this. So the setup is, it's shot in your living room. The only people in the audience are your parents who are seated on a couch. Your name is up in lights on the wall, lights like in those kind of 40-watt bulbs that you use in a lamp or something. and there's a pianist there, Wayne Fetterman. He's at the piano, like, playing intros. And you even have a warm-up comic played by Jackie Cation. And so I want to play the opening to The Special, Special, Special. And it opens, as a lot of, like, HBO comedy specials do, with, you know, the comic talking backstage behind the scenes about what the special is and why they're doing it. So first we're going to hear that, you know, fake interview, and then we'll hear the setup to the show. Here we go.
The reason I decided to do the special here was because it is free to perform in your own home.
We are at the Maria Bamford Special. Are you guys psyched? Are we all psyched?
Yeah. Sure, I've done television shows. I've been in a few seconds of certain movies. But the people I'm really creating things for are Joel and Marilyn Bamford, my parents. I do know their names, Joel and Marilyn Bamford.
It's Maria Bamford, performing live in her own living room in Eagle Rock, California. It's The Special, Special, Special. Tonight's only audience members, Maria's parents.
It's going to be a special, special, special.
All right, and we're ready. Let's hear you laugh. Let's hear you laugh. Hi. Yay! And the clapping, that's right. We're ready to begin. Wayne, let's get some music going, get Maria out here. You know her from birth. You've known her for a long time, since the very beginning. Let's have a big round of applause, a big Eagle Rock welcome for Maria Bamford.
Dedication! Wayne Fetterman! Thanks so much for coming, Mom and Dad.
That is really so amazing. What gave you the idea of doing a comedy special in your living room for your parents and recording it?
Well, I feel embarrassed to say this, but it was an act of a slight laziness where I was like, you know, I hadn't been feeling well the year prior, you know, and I didn't want to do a big crowd. Like, crowds kind of, it's funny because the bigger the crowds get, the more nervous I get. I actually am very comfortable with a half filled room of people who are slightly disinterested and are irritated at a Barnes and Noble. I just wanted to read magazines, and now there's a comedy show. I am more comfortable with that. And my parents are so supportive. They are also extremely inexpensive as talent. And it is true that the people who it makes me feel the best when they laugh are my family and friends. I mean, when they laugh, I feel great. Whereas you have a room of 300 people, and because that's what I pull, that's what I draw right now. that's a great feeling too, but it's, I think for me anyways, and you know, much richer experience to, if I get my dad to laugh, that is delightful.
So was the laughter fake or was it real?
No, I think it was. I mean, I think it's real. I think sometimes, I'm sure sometimes they're just kind of staring and being supportive. I can't imagine that there isn't some aspect of where they're just losing themselves in the idea that their daughter is doing something, and they're just proud that she's functioning relatively well. And I think, yeah, I don't know. You'd have to ask them what part of it is. But I know my mom has gotten irritated about certain, because sometimes my mom just writes the joke herself. She couldn't find me in the house once, and an object to rest stays at rest. I'm in a corner curled with my bristles to the outside. And she called my sister in a panic and said, Maria has disappeared, and I'm worried she's killed herself, and I have a hair appointment in town. Which, I mean, that is so hilarious. And, you know, you wouldn't dredge the shallows. She got very upset that I was going to say that. But then once she heard it a couple times live and people laughed, she was fine with it. Or she just says, oh, I never said that.
Did she really say that? Did she really say to your sister,
yes.
I'm afraid your sister's killed herself and I have a hair
yes.
appointment?
Yes.
And what did your sister say?
My sister just told me. she left it on the voicemail. She didn't have a chance to respond except to say, why don't you check the bed, Mom? Check the bed. She's probably in there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Maria Bamford, and she has a new comedy CD called Ask Me About My New God. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actress Maria Bamford. She has a new comedy CD, which is called Ask Me About My New God. You did a whole web series about you being in bed depressed.
Yes.
And it's called The Maria Bamford Show. And the premise was that you'd had a nervous breakdown and went home to Duluth, Minnesota to live in your parents' attic. And so you were recording yourself doing different characters with your little camcorder mostly in bed. Yes. And when I first saw it, I thought, like, okay, is this for real? Like, is she really living in her parents' attic? Did she really just have a nervous breakdown? Is she really recording this herself? And of course, there's a list of credits at the end, so I knew that wasn't true. again, like, how did you get the idea to do that? And were you living in your parents' home?
No. I think at that point it was sort of a worst fear slash.
But that you'd be so broken, you'd be like back home and taken care of by your parents.
Yeah, because I think I've always been a little on the edge psychologically, you know, feeling like that my brain felt a little bit out of my control. And so I always had a fantasy of being on a sitcom. And so I couldn't seem to get on one. And so I thought, well, I'll write a one-person show that would just be me in the sitcom. And then that became the web series. And it was really great to kind of act out that scenario. Because one thing I do miss out living far away from my family there in Minnesota. And so kind of doing impersonations of them, it allows me to feel close to them and think about what they would say and also control what they would say in a very controlled environment.
Another web series you did I want to ask you about is called Ask My Mom.
Yes.
And we're going to actually play an entire episode, which is like 90 seconds. These are like very, very short, and they're so much fun to watch. So do you want to talk about what the premise of Ask My Mom is?
Yeah, it's just I'd always wanted to do something with my mom because my mom has lots of great ideas and advice. But now she's retired and she's going on motorcycle tours of Norway. And so she doesn't have time. And so I thought, why not me dress up in an outfit and be her and answer people's questions from a Christian-based liberal point of view. See what she has to say for people, because she does have some wonderful... I do love my mom's attitude, so this is what happens.
Okay, so this is an episode of Maria Bamford's Ask My Mom.
The older I get, the less I know. The more I ask my mom! Don't ask me, ask my mom!
Why don't you Google it?
Your sister just posted a quote on Facebook. That which has been your deepest sorrow has been your greatest delight. Give me a break! Exclamation point. And a thumbs up the grandchildren. Your father keeps poking me. Sweetie, can I have your Facebook password?
No.
I just want to get in there.
No.
See what's going on.
Mom, here's a question. I was raised without religion, and I can't get myself to believe, but I'm jealous of the contentment, purpose, and peace of mind that religious and spiritual types seem to have. How can I get the same results, but without all the hocus pocus?
Well, you just go to a temple or a mosque or a church or a sit-in, and you just pretend. You just look around and say, oh, okay, you know, and then the fact that you don't believe, it makes you even more of a believer, really. All of the prophets doubted. Sweetie, what is your Facebook password? Is it I love pugs?
What? No!
That's Maria Bamford. One episode from her web series, Ask My Mom. And she also has a new comedy CD, which is called Ask Me About My New God. So do you really envy your mother's capacity for faith and wish that you had it?
Oh, I just think it must be so dreamy, you know, to just... My mom is very structured. She gets up. She does her prayers and eats her oatmeal with blueberries and Greek yogurt. And she, you know, has her prayer list, and then she doesn't worry too much about things, you know, like so-and-so came down with Alzheimer's, and so they're having a
hard time, and we're just, you know, I'm just going to take her for frozen yogurt at Scoops and teach her how to upload all her Weight Watchers points into the cloud. Like, you know, I'm taken out by a gas station muffin. I have the wrong muffin, and I'm out for a week, you know. And, you know, I fall asleep and fall into despair and tears. And, you know, she just pops up. She bobs. She's buoyed. Constantly buoyed.
I love how you do her voice.
Yeah. I mean, I think I do a good job. I mean, I think I'm genuinely becoming my mother. I mean, at some point, there's going to be no impersonation. It's just going to be full bleed. I am her. That's what my boyfriend says. He says, you just are your mom right now. So, but, you know, she's so fun. Who put weeds in my salad? Oh, it's arugula. Oh, I love arugula.
Oh. Maria Bamford will be back in the second half of the show. Her new comedy album is called Ask Me About My New God. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information is available at progressive.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985, cysimsfoundation.org. And from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the new mystery novel that became an overnight bestseller once it was revealed it was written under a pseudonym by J.K. Rowling. Also, comic and actress Maria Bamford tells us how she began taking self-improvement classes, and when those stopped working, she tried stand-up comedy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Maria Bamford. Much of her humor is about the things that trouble her most, and there's a long list, because she has OCD, bipolar disorder, and has dealt with suicidal thoughts. She often talks about her parents and her sister in her performances, and does their voices. When did you start doing voices, and what were the first voices that you did?
I think I mimicked some commercials, and I don't actually do very many voices. I only do about 6 or 7. Some are just versions of higher or lower versions of others. So, but I think it also in stand-up it helped because my own voice, some have said, is high, irritating, childlike. And so if you can change your voice, it
did grab people's attention.
You've done voiceover work for cartoons, right? Have you done a lot of different characters?
Yes. I'm on Adventure Time, which is a great series on the Cartoon Network. It's a beautiful show, just so weird and creative. And then I've done Word Girl on PBS, which is coming back. They're going to have Word Girl, which is a girl superhero who fights off villains with the power of vocabulary.
Are you Word Girl?
I am not Word Girl. That is played by someone else, but I am play her mother.
Do you use your mother's voice?
No. I use a basic, just a proud mother voice who's just proud and excited and wants everyone to be happy.
I love that voice that you do because it's in some ways you would describe it as a very nondescript voice, but it's not. Do you know what I mean? It's like the essence of a certain mainstream middle American voice.
Yeah. I think I've felt like a bit of a weirdo sometimes, so that sometimes that voice, it helps, you know, as sort of a counterpoint to what, I worked as a secretary for a long time, so I would have, sometimes would have female bosses who were, a female boss who acts like they're your friend, hey, I'm having a party at my house this week, and I really want you to come and meet some really cute, really available men at the door. Park their cars, take their coats, and speak only when spoken to. Because I see us as partners as equal, even though I earn, 850% more than you do, and you spend 12 hours a day here stuck in this office while I drive aimlessly around the city looking for caves and tunnels where I can call you with my cell phone.
I'm trying to imagine you as somebody's secretary.
Oh, yes. No, I was very quiet. I was not a...
Were you performing at the time?
Oh, yes. I'm very passive-aggressive, which is... So it was always very quiet at work and then talk about work outside of work. Yeah.
Yep. One of the things that you did when you were young is you went to Dale Carnegie classes, self-improvement classes. What was his famous book, How to Win Friends and Influence People?
Influence People. I was extremely depressed, and my dad, I was having trouble with falling asleep because I was staying up all night.
Trying to prevent yourself from doing bad things?
Bad things, and had developed sort of an eating disorder in order to kind of, I think, deal with my brain chemistry. I would... binge on huge amounts of food and then try to starve. And I think that is, you develop all these sort of addictions to try to manage, I feel like is part of what happened. And so I was sleeping all day at schools. My dad took me to the Dale Carnegie 18-week course at the Duluth Public Library that's shaped like an oar boat in the basement. And we went with many different salespeople and business people of the city. And we learned the four C's, don't criticize, condemn, or complain, compliment. The sweetest sound of a person's ear is the sound of their own name, Terry. And that you act enthusiastic and you will be enthusiastic. And it was really a cognitive behavioral program. Like it helped me enormously at the time.
Did you do the things I suggested, like repeat somebody's name a lot when you were talking to them?
I did it all the time. I did it my entire senior year. And in that way, I think that's how I got my first boyfriend. I was nominated to, I won the Winter Frolic Queen crown, I think genuinely because I started doing all these weird techniques. And because everyone was in high school, I think nobody picked up on the BS factor of it. And I think it was sincere. I was so desperately sincere. I tried to use the same tactics when I went to school out east, and it did not go over at all. I remember my roommates, I was going to Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and they were from New York. And they're like, why do you keep saying our name? they were just totally on to me immediately, and they were completely weirded out by the whole thing.
So then what if you couldn't use the Dale Carnegie techniques anymore? What did you do to tried to more comfortably relate to people?
Well, I fell into a deep depression.
That always helps.
That helps. And then I did start doing stand-up around that time and got involved in improv and theater.
Tell me more about how you started doing stand-up.
They had a talent show, and I had always done run for office in grade school, high school, because it involved doing a speech. And I just loved every time I got to do a speech. I really enjoyed that. I just enjoyed it, and I enjoyed people. I enjoyed that feeling. I'd been trained to play classical violin from the age of 3 through the Suzuki method. And my mom said when I was 3 years old, when I got up on stage, I just started smiling. Like, I just really enjoyed it. And I think there is something about I love structured social environments. Where there's rituals and, I love a support group, where everyone's timed in how long they can talk. Like, ugh, I just give me 3 minutes and and 1 minute for wrap up and I feel comfortable. I love that. So I think I got involved in that. And so then when the opportunity came up to do a talent show, I was like, oh, I'll just do a funny speech. And then they said, oh, that's stand-up. And I was like, okay. Well, then I guess that's what I'm going to show up for, and began doing that.
Who were some of the comics that influenced you early on?
My dad and I and my sister, we'd always watch Saturday Night Live. So we saw Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy. So that's what we listened to in the car and on the record player, and just listen to it over and over again. I didn't really even understand the jokes, but I didn't even think of it as a possibility. Even as I was doing it, I didn't think I was what I was doing, because there just was no one in entertainment in my family, and there weren't as many women doing it, and it wasn't an option. It was either you be an actress, and I didn't really know what it was.
My guest is Maria Bamford. Her new comedy album is called Ask Me About My New God. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Maria Bamford. She has a new comedy CD, which is called Ask Me About My New God. You feel very comfortable on stage, but do you have anxiety before a performance?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm trying to work on that now. I don't know why that I still seem to go down some sort of rabbit hole of doubt and genuine terror. That is somehow, when I thought that, once you had more success that you'd feel more buoyed or you'd feel more confident. But in fact, my brain has the gift of switching it around to saying, oh, now people are expecting something. Now you're really gonna, let people down. And so I'm trying to, do all the... write more reasonable thoughts like, I can stand on stage for an hour and do work that I've prepared. And it's okay if there's a variety of responses. Like they teach you in some of the outpatient treatment, how to create more reasonable thoughts rather than catastrophic and or... hyperbolic thoughts?
Hyperbolic, yeah, uh-huh.
Hyperbolic thoughts, which that's what Los Angeles runs at. I am an angel.
How have you learned to deal with hecklers? Since you're prone to depression and prone to violent thoughts, when somebody's, like, you know, saying nasty things about you when you're performing, or they're booing, or, you know, being rude in some way, what's it like for you?
Well, it genuinely doesn't happen as much. I think with the internet, you really can draw specifically your crowd, which is a good and a
sure.
bad thing.
Well, people are coming to hear you now, but I guess earlier when it was like an open mic night or something.
Yes, and any night in Los Angeles where anywhere where people don't know what they've come to see, I can get booed. And I love the United States and that we are a free democracy and everyone is able to speak their minds. And so I think that is the excitement of live performance, that people can say, I'm unhappy, you know, like, I'm uncomfortable and this isn't what I wanted. So I'm trying. I'm still not very good at it. My knees will shake. You know, I will have a sense of righteous rage come up inside of me if somebody says something, you know, like, get off stage, you suck, or I try to say something that isn't mean, just because I've heckled people, and heckling is just, I think, sometimes wanting to participate and wanting to just, you're frustrated and you just feel like, oh, this is weird, uncomfortable, and somebody's got to say something.
I want to play another track from the new CD, and this is called Joy Whack-A-Mole, and it's something your family used to do, you've defined as this game.
Yes.
So why don't we hear this this bit from your act, and then we'll talk about it.
This is a little game you can play with your friends and family. I hope you do if you don't already play it. Just leave you with it. It's a... My family called Joy Whack-A-Mole. What happens is that somebody brings up something that they're really happy about, and then the other person tries to slam it down. I was playing with my dad, and I was like, Dad, check out this new top. Oh, it's very nice. Yeah, guess how much? I don't know, $50. No. Five. Jeez, that's a good deal. Yeah, you got that right. It's like $5. How do they do it? Oh, I was reading about that. Slavery. Yeah, you put the manufacturing out of these countries. There's no labor laws, human rights violations, no environmental protection. And then they pass that savings on to you. Pretty sweet coat, though, Dad. It kind of skims the profile. My mom is truly the king of this game, though. She's very good. Mom, Amy hit her baby. Oh, that is great news, honey. I mean, it's not the greatest news for the 600,000 kids in foster care in this country, but she wants a fresh one, huh? Jeez. Everybody wants one that looks like them. It's so selfish. Mama, I'm doing a show tonight. Oh, sweetie, I have a joke for you. A friend of mine is just a hoot. She said you could use it. And coincidentally, she was in foster care. She had been airlifted out of the Sudan in the late 90s because she had been bearmed and belegged by the Janjaweed, the horseback militia. Anywho, she'd love to do stand-up. She's hilarious, but she can't. And it's really a hospice situation, just a matter of time, but the priest comes in and he asks her, would you like us to light a candle for you in the chapel? Well, she says, sassy as you please, teletyping through her eyelids, well, how many candles you got? Because so many horrible things have happened to her and keep happening.
happening, sweetie? Have a good show tonight. What you do is so important.
That's Maria Bamford from her new CD, Ask Me About My New God. Do you play Joy Whack-A-Mole with yourself every time something good happens?
Sure.
Undermine
sure.
It? Yeah.
Oh, Maria, you're on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You're no longer underdog status, so people are going to hate you. You're on Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's a negative to every positive. Now I'm a winner, Terry. You've made it official. I'm a winner.
I've conferred that status.
Yes.
As,
oh,
as
yes.
Only I can.
Yes, yes.
So, so do you talk about all this with your family? Like, before you do something like Joy Whack-A-Mole, do you call your parents? Or before you do anything in which you're going to be doing the voices of your family, do you call them and test it out and make sure, like, are you okay with this?
No, I don't. I mean, I will tell them jokes just because I like to hear them laugh. But now that my parents have so many different phones, it's hard for them to hear things. So it's a very frustrating joke performing context for them. And then the last time I did a joke for my dad said, "Oh, geez, no wonder you're still single." And they don't get to hear the jokes unless they have positive feedback and laughs. That's the agreement. And so sometimes, yeah, I don't tell them the jokes. And they're so busy now since they retired. They're learning how to make shoes. They're going to Esalen, that place where you nude hot tub and talk to an empty chair that represents your dead mother. I don't know. They're busy.
Wow. Is it hard to imagine your parents naked in a hot tub?
Well, I didn't go visit them up there. It's up in Big Sur, and you know, they have their lives, and they like to celebrate the body. And you know, the great thing about my mom is she did affirm that you know, sexuality is important. And you know, your father lost confidence after the prostate surgery, but then he went out and he bought himself a used Dodge Caravan, and we are back in business. Anyways, you can always be sensual up until your 90s, you know, from what my mom has sent me, and according to clippings in the AARP magazine. So we're never off the hook, Terry. There are tools, there are unguents, lotions, potions. Get on it.
Maria Bamford, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been such an honor and a pleasure. I feel so excited. Thank you.
Maria Bamford's new comedy album that comes with the DVD of her Comedy Central specials is called Ask Me About My New God. You'll find a link to her web series, The Maria Bamford Show, on our website, freshair.npr.org. The revelation that the new novel, The Cuckoo's Calling, by Robert Galbraith, was really written by J.K. Rowling, turned the book into a bestseller. But is it good? Our book critic Maureen Corrigan weighs in after a break. This is Fresh Air. The literary event of the summer is something that's caught readers and reviewers by surprise, a debut mystery novel by one of the world's most famous living authors. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Call it The Mystery of the Missing Book Sales, and I don't think we'll be needing to bring Sherlock Holmes in to solve this one. In April, a debut mystery entitled The Cuckoo's Calling was published. It appeared to be written by an unknown British writer named Robert Galbraith, who was identified on the book jacket as a former military cop now working in private security. The novel received some good reviews. Publishers Weekly, for instance, called it a stellar debut. But an unknown author trying to break into an overcrowded genre needs more than approving cliches to make an impact. In the UK, a mere 1,500 copies had been sold. By last week, the novel was deader than a firecracker stand on a rainy 5th of July. Then, the Sunday Times of London received an anonymous tip via Twitter that Robert Galbraith was actually a pseudonym for J.K. Rowling. The Times, in checking out the tip, ran The Cuckoo's Calling through forensic stylometric software and found a strong match with Rowling's Harry Potter books. As soon as the news of Rowling's ruse broke this past Sunday, sales of The Cuckoo's Calling soared. The novel has shot to number one in Amazon online sales, and an additional 300,000 hardcovers have been rushed into print. Signed first editions of The Cuckoo's Calling are selling for around $1,000 on eBay. I think my unsigned first edition probably got packed off in one of the shopping bags full of unwanted review copies I donated to the library a few weeks ago. So, like hundreds of thousands of antsy J.K. Rowling fans who can't wait for the hardcover, I downloaded the electronic version on my Kindle. And you know what? The library is welcome to my review copy and whatever funds it may raise. The Cuckoo's Calling falls into that vast Midland range of fiction that I mentally shelve in the I've read worse but I've read better category. I couldn't even find a memorable quote from this novel. The only really distinctive thing about The Cuckoo's Calling is its title, which comes from a Christina Rossetti poem. Rowling has written a respectable urban example of what's been called the Mayhem Parva school of British detective fiction. The story takes place in a circumscribed setting, it's full of oddball suspects, and the killer is affably lurking in plain sight throughout much of the action. Rowling's private eye hero is named Cormoran Strike. He's an ex-military policeman who lost a leg in Afghanistan. We meet him in the archetypal dumpy office where he passes his days staring into the bottom of a bottle and running to fat. Think Hagrid in a trench coat. Strike's fortunes change when he hires a young temp secretary named Robin Ellicott as his gal Friday. Also stumbling through the Deus Ex Machina door is a client whose sister, the famous model Lula Landry, has died after falling from the balcony of her apartment. The client insists it was murder and hires Strike to find out. Investigations ensue. Rowling tries to bring a more contemporary edge to this novel by featuring a beautiful biracial victim and delving into the demimonde of high fashion and hip-hop royalty. But the world here still feels curiously dated. In fact, the first time we glimpse Robin, the young secretary, she's bedazzled by getting an engagement ring affixed to her finger by her stodgy fiancé. Throughout much of the stories, she serves coffee to clients, makes cow eyes at Strike, and tidies up the office loo. The most intriguing, unsolved mystery in The Cuckoo's Calling is why, in this post-Lisbeth Salander age, Rowling would choose to outfit her female lead with such meek and anachronistic feminine behavior. No matter, Rowling is laughing all the way to the vault. Another Cormoran Strike novel, in what is already shaping up to be a blockbuster series, is set to come out in 2014. My advice is, if you want to read a really spectacular detective story about a victim falling off a balcony, read Michael Connelly's 2011 novel, The Drop, now out in paperback. His hero, Harry Bosch, is to detectives what Harry Potter is to boy wizards. the top of the line.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling. If you'd like to check it out for yourself, you can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states make evidence-based policy and budget decisions at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dean Norris, who's currently starring in the CBS drama Under the Dome. And next month, when Breaking Bad returns for its final episodes, he'll be back as DEA agent Hank Schrader.
There's this mystery man I've been chasing for the better part of a year. Cooks the purest meth that me or anyone else has ever seen.
Join us.